Yeah, so I mean, in my mind, marketing is sort of the foundation of any company or corporation, right? I mean, there's the obvious things, right? Like we own the website, we own the messaging and branding, and we're the ones who are bringing the leads in. But if you think about that customer journey, and we look at it a very linear way, it starts with having a product or solution, right? So how can marketing help product do a better job and understand things? We own chat, which is where a lot of the complaints come in. We're the ones who are developing those user groups and customer events and things like that, where we're getting feedback. And so we really can help product understand what can and should be developed and in the priority, and then how it can actually be sold as well, like how we're going to bundle it, how we're going to price it. These are things that marketing is actually involved with, but people don't think about marketing as being part of that product team.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, man, this is going to be a great conversation because we're going to talk about the one thing that marketers need to succeed. And we're going to do that with Christina Del Villar. I couldn't even get the last name out. I know. So we're going to be able to talk about really core essentials associated with the success of, of course, we focus in on B2B marketers. It's not just digital marketing anymore. As they say, some people say it's just marketing. She's also the author of the book called Sway. And as far as the subtitle is concerned, so
it's very long.
Yeah. I got the book jacket there, and I got the book here. Thank you for sending a hard copy. Yes. It's Implement the Grit Marketing Method to Gain Influence and Drive Corporate Strategy. A very good book. And we're going to go through and hit some of the key points in this book so that you can have greater success as a marketer. And, I think one of the last, stats that I saw about chief marketing, type of officers, that is the average tenure is only about 18 months now, and it's continuing to shorten.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. It takes like 6 to 12 months to hire them. Then they're 6 months to onboard. Then they have a year to be successful, and then they move on to the next one.
Exactly. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But Christina, before we get into that, if you could share with the B2B DM gang just a little bit about your background.
Yeah. So again, Christina Del Villar, I spent the last 30 years in Silicon Valley as a marketing executive and really focused a lot on B2B marketing and companies that were coming up around technology, and then really focused on the go-to-market strategy. So I think there's several components. Marketing, but the go-to-market strategy, if we're not aligned with that and don't understand that, hopefully own it, it's much harder for us to do our job. So that is really what I focused on for those 30 plus years now.
Yeah. And we'll hit on that a little bit too, as well, because I mean, for me, what I run into with a lot of my clients that I work with in regards to, lead generation in the B2B space is once I start, peeling back, the layers in regards to their go-to-market strategy, I'm like, we got a problem.
We don't have a go-to-market strategy.
It's going to be difficult for us to do our work when, we have some holes, at the starting point.
Right.
But in the book, and I think this is one of the things, which is a good foundation and starting point that you have for the book, is you talk about that most people think marketing as being non-essential.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that, ironically, I think marketing has done they've done themselves a disservice by not being clear about what it is that they do, what it is that they bring to the table, and showing the results in such a way that people understand everything that they are doing and bringing to the table. You know, again, what is it? The cobbler's children have the worst shoes. It's like the marketers do the worst job of marketing themselves internally. We do a great job marketing to our customers and our audiences, but we don't do a good job of really understanding the fact that most people don't even know what we do. They think we, you know, we, you know, make cool t-shirts, we build great VIP parties and name cool cocktails. But there's a lot more that we do. And we need to start helping people understand that, again, in context for them.
Well, and as you say that, it kind of goes back to one of the things you kind of mentioned a moment ago in regards to that whole tenure component and who you're reporting to. And in the book, you mentioned how you had so many changes in senior management that you really spent most of your time essentially, you know, introducing them and giving them the lay of the land more than you did getting your work done.
Right. Well, I mean, if you think about CMOs lasting 18 months, right, like you spend that, you as a marketing professional are like training your new manager, your new boss, the new CMO for a good 6 months, helping them understand what it is that the company does, you know, what the programs are. And then often they'll come in with some of their own, you know, things that they're used to doing and ways that they're used to doing it. And so it's this, this revolving door of managers that you have. I think when I was at Oracle, I had 8 or 9 managers in like a 3.5 year period. And, you know, not only are you training them in terms of like, this is who I am, this is what our team does, this, these are the results we bring in, this is why we need this budget. You're also like, literally like, how can you get promoted if your manager doesn't know who you are and what you're doing? So from a personal standpoint and a career standpoint, you're trying to help them understand that. Then from, you know, the campaigns and programs you're trying to execute, you're trying to help them understand that. It's tough. It's a tough job.
Yeah. Instead of when you start thinking about it, them supporting you and you being more effective, you end up essentially having to handhold them just to bring them up to speed.
Right. Yeah. And it's more than just managing the manager, right? It is helping them because you want them to be successful because you need to be successful. So you need to help them understand sort of what the culture is, what the lay of the land is, that sort of thing as well.
So in a book, you bring up a really interesting, for me, it's like, provoking, you know, well, there are several, but you talk about the sales cycle affecting marketing. Yeah. And you made that to really be, you know, significantly more clear for me than it ever has before. So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the sales cycle affecting marketing and that revolving manager piece, how that fits in, as well as executive expectation.
Oh my gosh, there's a lot there, right? I mean, I think this is something key, and I know we're going to get into a lot with the go-to-market strategy itself. Everything should start with your go-to-market strategy, and then you align with that. But you really have to understand what your customer journey is, that entire journey. So if you are, I don't know, let's say when I worked at Oracle, it's like a 10 or 20 year relationship you have with these folks. So when they come in, they're prospects. The funnel we often think about stops when somebody buys, but it's a very long journey even to get to that point where they're buying. There's a lot of people that come into that buyer's journey, the component, that piece of the customer journey. Like for the most part, B2B sales have an average of like 17 to 25 people on that prospect side who are going to come in at certain points. And, you know, they might come in, might be the IT person who has to implement it. They're going to come in halfway through, might be the end user who is the first person to recommend it, but then they're out of that journey until the end where now they're, or maybe they're in as part of a trial, or now they're in because now you've purchased it and they're being onboarded. So you have to think about all of this, not just one or two people that you're selling to, it's everybody in that buying process. And so that's why it's critical to really understand what that is and where that friction comes in, and what the objections of each of those people are, and what is motivating each of those people in that buyer's journey. So you really have to think about it. It's a really long and complicated, I have like a spreadsheet that's like 1,000 lines long that has everything in there, like when they're going to touch the product, when they're going to talk to you, who they're going to talk to, who the CFO wants to talk to, because it really helps marketers develop the campaigns that they need to, the content that they need to, the content that's going to touch those individuals when they need to see that information. And so you really have to think about that. And again, the friction points are really key as well. And so again, if you on your side have these revolving doors, they on the other side have those revolving doors. hours too. Can't tell you how many times I've been in those sales cycles and, you know, they bring marketing in for some help and guidance. And suddenly that champion that you've been working with, they went to another company or they got a promotion or who knows what. And sometimes you literally have to start that entire process all over again.
But there's so much truth to that. And that's, to me, brought so much clarity. You know, when you were talking about, you know, how oftentimes marketing is perceived and, you know, the whole lead generation process and the whole conversion process and that, you know, executives like, we got to get leads now. I'm like, well, wait a minute, we have an 18-month sales cycle. Okay, so what we have to do is we have to take them, you know, in, across that entire, you know, timeline and all of these, you know, multiple touch points like you're referring to.
Yeah. It's interesting. I did, when I was at a company, we had a 12-month sales cycle and, my management team was very supportive, but they got super excited. We did a webinar as part of a thought leader program and we had 80,000 people on the webinar, which was kind of insane. And I was super excited. And the very next day I'm still like on this, you know, cloud nine high. And, they're like, yeah, that was amazing. And then the second question they asked is, how much revenue did it bring in? And I was like, from the webinar I did yesterday, I'm like, nothing. I'm still spending money. Are you kidding me? And so you have to set those expectations, but you have to know, you know, webinars are going to actually take 16 months, not even 12 months. And what does that 16 month entail? And again, to that buyer's journey, who's going to come in at month two, at month 12, at month, you know, 16, so that you can really focus on them and help your sales team be successful in closing that deal.
Yeah, but in the book, you met before we were actually recorded, you talked about you being described as being snarky. So your snarky response was, how long is our sales cycle?
That is exactly what it was. Actually, you know, I might have dropped an F-bomb on him too.
You're like, ask me then.
Ask me in 12 months. Are you kidding me? Yeah. And it was funny because I can't remember if it's in the book, but like 11 and a half months later, the VP of sales, the GM, the CEO of the company, they all called me up and they're like, hey, we just want to let you know, we totally just hit that revenue target that you said we would hit in 12 months. I'm like, yeah, it's our sales cycle.
As they say, yeah, mic drop.
Right?
They get it now. Yeah,
they
get it now. Well, and I think that's part of what you kind of touched upon when you said the marketers not, and let me just, where would you put it? It says you need to market the marketer. Explain that a little bit more.
Yeah. So again, that's what we do. We market things. We market our solutions. We market our services. And we need to do a better job of marketing ourselves. We need to understand our audiences, understand our products, make sure that they understand what our features and functionalities are, the benefits of us are, the results that they're going to get, our ROI, like everything that we do as a marketer, you know, to our external audience, we need to start doing to our internal audience. And it's not just the executives and the leaders, it's everybody across the entire organization, because a lot of people just they don't understand, you know, what it is that we do. And on the flip side of that, we as marketers also need to really understand in context what it is that the rest of the teams are doing. Why is engineering saying that they have to do the roadmap this way, right? These are the priorities. It's like, well, why? And this is what we'd like you to do. And let me explain why it's important and why it's critical to revenue, to bottom line, to everything that we have going on, or maybe an event that we have coming up. We have to help people understand in context what it is that we do and what it is that we're trying to accomplish.
Okay. So, gosh, I mean, as you say, there's a whole lot that could be unpacked. And as we were, before we started recording, it's like, oh, this is going to be a six-hour interview.
Series one of 12.
Most definitely. Well, and that's why you need to get the book, right? So you can see how all this lays out. You know, if I start thinking about, you know, you talk about grit and needing grit, and you say that's going to fix all the B2B marketers' problems. We need to know what grit really stands for. So what does grit stand for? Or what is grit?
Yeah. So obviously I think, you know, we know the main definition of grit, like it's just having this this sort of inner strength and robustness and kind of courage. It's a whole bunch of things put together. But GRIT for me, you know, I took it and turned it into an acronym that I think will help marketers and marketing professionals be successful. And so the GRIT stands for go-to-market strategy. I'll kind of deep dive a little bit into these in a second. The R stands for repeatable, predictable, and measurable. The I stands for intention, and the T stands for tools and technologies. And I think if you frame these four things, are obviously we can unpack a lot of those and spend hours on each of them. But if you have sort of those four components, I think you'll be a lot more successful. So when I talk about go-to-market strategy, for me, again, it's really important for organizations as a whole to have a go-to-market strategy, for it to be a very succinct written document that people can refer back to, that somebody owns and somebody's being held accountable for the execution of it. And it's a long-term plan. It's not, you know, it's not your annual, it's not a tactical plan. It is your strategy, a corporate strategy. Like if your strategy is to, you know, increase from 50 to 100 million in 5 years, that is the strategy you need to be focusing on. That's the end goal. So if you as a company have that, and you as a marketing professional have that, you can basically align everything you're doing with product, sales, marketing, customer success, you know, whatever your customer journey looks like, to that strategy. And then everything you're doing as a marketing professional needs to lean into that, right? So everything you do needs to, at the end of the day, focus on that strategy. So it makes it really easy for marketers to invest in the right types of things and divest in other things. And it also gives marketers, and really everyone, permission to say no, which I think is part of the battle that we in marketing have. Like we're the ones who everybody comes to for everything. Like we need a hat, we need, you know, a new slide, we need, I don't know, we need new signage on the outside of our building. All of these things, you know, they make us less productive and efficient and effective than we could be because we're kind of focused on these other things. But the worst part about it is because there's sort of these ancillary things that we just do, we're not being, you know, we're not being reviewed on them. They're not part of our, you know, our bonus structure. They're not part of our review process. And so this is kind of what I'm talking about. Like we're seen as you know, non-essential because we do all these other things. And then sure, yeah, like I don't need a baseball cap, so marketing's non-essential, right? But at the end of the day, there's so much more that we're doing that people aren't seeing and understanding. And we need to kind of flip that around. First off, stop doing the things that are non-essential and are not going to help us get to that end goal of that go-to-market strategy. And then we need to help people understand what it is that we actually are doing to help us get to those end goals.
Well, I mean, as you're talking, and that, like you say, the something to stand upon to say no is probably more important than saying yes.
It is because again, that I think it's in the book. I had my team basically for one full week record everything that they were doing, and the interruptions that they had that were not pertinent to that end goal, for the go-to-market strategy as a whole. And the average was 250 interruptions a week. And so that's 50 a day. You're getting interrupted 50 times a day to do things that are not strategic. And, it was super easy for me to, you know, say this is, we're not doing this anymore. And basically what it did, it gave them permission to say no, gave us permission to divest in areas that did not make sense. But it also helps because then when somebody says, hey, can you do this? You can say, well, is this going to help us reach our $100 million revenue goal in 5 years? And if they say yes, then ask them, how is it going to do that? And if they can't answer either of those questions, then they themselves already know that they're wasting your time. and it might take some time, you know, to say no, or to like, I'll do this last time, but then you're on your own, whatever it is. But I think it's important for people to know that, again, it's actually more strategic to say no in some cases than it is to say yes and to do things.
Well, to me, that kind of goes back full circle into that whole leader component, you know, and if they're switching leaders every 18 months, I mean, you have somebody coming in brand new that wants to say yes, 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 right?
Oh, right. They want to please. We all want to please, right? But yes, those folks in particular, they're like, well, gosh, and And oftentimes in the back of their head or even out loud, they're like, well, this is, I guess, is this how they do it here? Like this, okay, I guess that's what I'll do, right? And even then you'll give it some time and then you'll realize like, no, this isn't, we don't need to do it this way. We don't need to keep doing it this way. But that's why you really need strong leaders in there. And that's why, I mean, part of what the book is talking about is building that influence and trust internally so that you can say no and people don't question it, right? Or you can ask for things and people don't question it anymore.
Well, even the book, you talk about the vital importance of understanding specialization. Like you gave one scenario where an organization, you know, going through the COVID, they actually let go of their event person. And then they were like, okay, we need to take this face-to-face event and make it all virtual. And you're like, so you guys need to do that. And you're like, well, you let go of our event person.
you let go of all of them. They're all gone. Yeah. It was, it was a client that I was working for and they literally turned to the writer and they were like, okay, well, you're in marketing. So y'all must be interchangeable. So can you just figure out how to do virtual events? That'd be great. And the poor person was like, what? no. And then they look at you like, well, but you're in marketing. And it's like, that's not how that works. It's like, if you're in engineering, it's like, you know, Python, you know, C++, you're not necessarily interchangeable. So it's interesting that people think that, again, not only are we non-essential, but we're interchangeable, which would mean if we are, we're like super, super power people.
Well, and the reality is, I mean, these things, you know, when you start looking at marketing and the landscape shifts and buyer, you know, preferences and, you know, the buyer journey, and we'll talk about in a second, is, you know, with all of the magnitude of shifts, the specialization is more important than it has ever become. And much even when we start talking about the leader, if the leader comes in and has a specialization in one particular area, it may just, you know, cause total chaos.
Right. And it's interesting because normally I am brought into organizations that are like pivoting. So I'll come in when they're like direct to consumer and they're switching to B2B. And so not only they're not used to this at all, there's a huge cultural change. And so it is important to do that. You know, when I have interviewed for, you know, leadership roles in the past, they always ask me like, who would be your first hire? And I'm like, well, I don't know enough yet about the product, the solution, our audience, our customers, to be able to tell you, like, would I focus on social media? Would I focus on content? Would I focus on ads? Like, I don't know yet. So it's hard for me to say who that first hire would actually be.
And say, I don't know about a hire, but I know who I'm going to bring in. And that's God, because you guys need some prayers.
You guys need some help. I think it's beyond that for you guys.
just burn it.
No.
Sometimes that forklift has to happen though, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. When I work with clients now, I won't use the F-bomb, but I have my cluster premium. So if you're like, this is what I charge and it's pretty standard. But if you're just a mess, I'm going to charge you 50% more because it's going to take me longer to sort through that.
That's too funny. So I call it the PETA factor.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's my adjustment. And PETA factor stands for pain in the arse.
Yes. Yes. I get it. Yes. So, and you have to charge more because it's a mess that you have to go in and fix. So.
Well, and then, so you talked about, okay, take a look at grit. The number one most important. Oh,
I didn't even get to RIT either.
I know. And because I want to make sure that we talk about, because you talk about and you hit on it, is the level of importance, you know, so what do you actually see? And this is because I want to make sure you hit on this, is the most common thing that you see, you know, that's a problem with go-to-market strategies.
Yeah. So I think that a couple of big things. One is that companies actually don't have go-to-market strategies. They really don't. They have this sort of, this is our mission, this is our vision, and then here are the annual tactical plans to help us get there. And that's not what that is. It should be a long-term strategic very strategic process that everybody in the company is aligned with. So again, at any point in time, and I have CEOs do this all the time when I'm, you know, talking to them about, you know, whether I want to take them on as a client, I'm like, go ask 10 of your employees what the go-to-market strategy is. And they're like, oh yeah, everybody knows this is our number one goal. And they come back to me and sometimes they're like, well, they understood the goal, but they all said it differently, right? They use different words, which is important as well. And then other people, most of them come back and they're like, yeah, these people don't even know what company they're working for. So that, you know, that's a problem. And that's from management down. Like, you have not done this. You've not set in place what this strategy is going to look like and how you're going to get there. And the types of people, roles, and skills you need to get there. So once you actually, if you actually have that go-to-market strategy, then the other key component is who actually owns this. Like a hot potato, like everybody thinks they own it, but nobody wants it. And nobody, you know, knows where it is. Nobody's really being held accountable. And I really feel like one person should be held accountable for the execution of it. That's not to say that they're doing it all, but they're responsible for making sure that it gets executed and that it's being, you know, looked at. So I think those are some major, major problems. The other thing I think that happens is, you know, people, we work in these silos, and I get that, right? We're super busy. We're going to go and we're going to do this. And we sometimes lose sight of what that strategy is or what other people are doing. And so what generally pops up are what I call passion projects. And those are projects that actually aren't in alignment with the strategy. And somehow they get started and then they're just like running loose, you know, and it's hard to like reel them in. But again, I think everybody at every point in time should be asking themselves, is this going to help us reach that 5-10 year plan? And how? Because sometimes, you know, you might not reach your annual tactical goals, but if it's still getting you to those longer term goals, then it might make sense to continue doing those. So again, I think it's that it doesn't exist, and it doesn't exist in a way that everybody understands what that is, and that there's no focus to make sure that it's happening, right? Like most companies, they might have like a CRO, a chief revenue officer, but they're still more focused on that, you know, quarterly and annual revenue drive that's going on and quotas and things like that. And the CEO, who really owns the go-to-market strategy at the end of the day, has probably, you know, they don't have time to like, you know, on a day-to-day basis, make sure that it's happening. And it could be a different person in each organization. It could be a COO, it could be, you know, a GM, it could literally be, your title could be, you know, go-to-market strategy. But that needs to be established. And again, alignment across that is just critical across the entire company.
Okay, so keep on going, please.
Grit. Okay, so grit. So R stands for repeatable, predictable, and measurable. And this is where I want all marketing professionals to get to, because this helps build believability with what it is that you're doing and the results that you're sharing. So if you have something, a lot of people think that they need to build something new. And I don't think you necessarily need to do that. You don't necessarily need different ads or new content or, you know, whatever somebody else is asking you to do. You need to be super efficient and concise with what you have. And I think that consistency is actually more critical. You know, quality versus quantity is really key. And so I like to say, you know, if you have something that you can use and kind of keep using it in context with the audience that you're looking at, you will actually get to this predictability. Like, you'll know what it does. I know how webinars perform. I know how this piece of content will perform. I know how, you know, like this user group is going to, I know what they're going to bring to the table. And if you have that, again, it's just much easier to be able to get to that strategy and have people understand again what you're doing, because your results, like you can say this is what we're going to get, and then that's what you get, and then it just helps you with that trust and influence that you have. The I stands for intention. I think again, kind of goes back to that strategy. Everything you do should be done with intention. If you have no idea why you're doing it, then you probably shouldn't be doing it. It should always tie back to either that annual tactical plan or that strategic plan. And then the T stands for tools and technology. I think marketers are often afraid of data and some of the tools. You know, we're not IT experts. We don't know how to integrate Salesforce, but we still need to have that knowledge in terms of what we want that workflow to look like, how we want that tool to perform, the data that we need to get out of it. And oftentimes we leave that to somebody else, whether it's IT or, you know, even like a marketing or sales ops person, which is fine. But then we don't understand And we can't capture the right data that we need, again, to sort of help us show those results in a way that's meaningful for folks.
Talking about data or data.
Data, yeah, data.
Man, you talk about how most organizations, their data is just, it's
bad.
Good. Yeah. And you talk about how, the shifts in all of, the marketplace would include preference, which would include all these things. And when you start looking at the data that an organization possesses, it's like, we almost have to start from nothing.
Yeah. I think the part of the problem is we don't do a good job understanding and using data. And so we just kind of collect it all. And then it's just this mess. There's like too much data that we can't figure out and sort through. And again, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we are not the owners of selecting necessarily and implementing those tools and putting in place the workflows, right? So we really do need to understand what it is that we're trying to extrapolate so that we can help make sure that it's being built properly. Because I guarantee you, every company has the data they need to understand and develop the right types of campaigns and to get to that predictability. It's just in so many different places and they're not, they're not tied together the right way. We're not pulling the right data. We're not understanding it. And I think, like AI is going to help with that because that's going to, with machine learning, it's going to learn what we really want it to learn, but we still have to tell it what we want it to learn. And we still have to give it the training data that we have to make it work. And so without sort of that knowledge, and again, I think people are just kind of afraid of data. But I think it's important to really understand how it's working and where it is and to really just own that. You're going to have a much easier time sort of manipulating it in a good way and using it for your benefit if you actually know where it is and what it means.
Well, and using some of our old analogies, though, AI is not going to spin, your trash and hay and
things. Right.
It ain't going to happen.
Yeah, like garbage in, garbage out. Same thing with AI. Like if your training data is crap or you're putting too much in because you don't know, it's not going to like parse it out for you. It's going to take what you give it and use that. So yeah, so be careful with AI.
Okay. So for me, I have a lot of background and experience, working in customer service and inbound sales and talking about that part of an operation. They're dealing with all aspects of an organization. They're essentially answering, to the customer for everything that the organization does. But yet you talk about marketing being the ultimate cross-functional organization.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So, in my mind, marketing is sort of the foundation of any company or corporation, right? I mean, there's the obvious things, right? Like we own the website, we own the messaging and branding, and we're the ones who are bringing the leads in. But if you think about that customer journey and we look at it a very linear way, it starts with having a product or solution, right? So how can marketing help product do a better job and understand things? We own chat, which is where a lot of the complaints come in. We're the ones who are developing those user groups and customer events and things like that where we're getting feedback. And so we really can help product understand what can and should be developed and in the priority and then how it can actually be sold as well, like how we're going to bundle it, how we're going to price it. These are things that marketing is actually involved with, but people don't think about marketing as being part of that product team. Obviously, marketing, we do lead gen, things like that. But from a sales standpoint, we're also very much involved in what sales is doing. We are helping them. That's our job, is to enable sales, right? So we're providing them with content. We're getting them quality leads. We're making sure they understand, anything, any promotions that are coming out. And so we really are an integral part of that sales organization as well. We're helping them remove some of the friction. So we work really closely with them. And then from a customer success standpoint, again, I work a lot with B2B. So these are long-term relationships, hopefully, that we have with these customers. And people call it customer support, right? So they're the ones answering the tickets when things go wrong, but it's really customer success because you want these people with you for a really long time. You want them to use your product, love your product and continue to expand that relationship with your product in your company. And so you really want to make sure that marketing is involved in that, just as you would do a nurture program for marketing and you would do a nurture program for sales. You need to do a nurture program for your customers that you have as well. And that's all marketing, working hopefully closely with those different organizations, or if you have a customer marketing person. But again, we are integral to all of those pieces. And that's why, you know, I feel like marketing is sort of that underbelly of the company, if you will. But again, nobody sees that and recognizes that. We just kind of do it. We do it on a daily basis and don't, you know, I'm not saying like in meetings, we'd be like, hey, we helped customer success, you know, last week. But we need to make it clear what it is that we're doing and bringing to the table.
Yeah. As you said that, I started thinking, I'm like, okay, your product is not going to become sticky because of fancy how-tos.
Right. Yeah, I think it's in the book. There's an example of even our website, you know, it was the engineers and product team are like, these are the features and this is, you know, this is what we're going to do. And so then they wrote a bunch of, manuals because it was a, you know, a complex thing. And this is, but it was for graphic designers. And so you're handing a graphic designer a manual, like they're, that's gone, right? And so again, you just need to be more aligned and working more closely and helping people understand what it is that in context that everybody's bringing to the table, not just marketing, obviously. A little partial and biased, but.
Rightfully so. Okay. So you touched on right there a second ago, the customer journey. You said, okay, yeah. Well, if you think about that as far as a linear path, but that's not what you refer to it as. You say the customer journey is really a swirly, twirly, hot mess. Explain that.
Yeah. I mean, this, again, for B2B in particular, not necessarily for, you know, transactional D2C, you know, direct to consumer. But even that, there's a lot of complexity that goes into it. But if you think about, again, let's just take a product, a solution that has this, it's a very long journey. It's a year and a half, 18-month sales cycle, you know, multi-million dollar deal. You're selling like 1,000 seat licenses, and there's probably 20 people on the potential customer side of things that are involved in this buyer's journey. And you need to think about, again, who are they? What do they care about? When are they going to come into that journey? Because you can say like, okay, this is the first thing we give people. This is the second thing we give people. This is the third thing we give people. But is it the first thing you give the engineer, or is it the first thing you give, you know, the end user? Or is this, you have to really understand, again, sort of their journey. So that you can, I know we talk about this all the time, like give the right piece of content to the right person at the right time. But it's critical, and it sounds, you know, cliche, but if you're not doing that, then, you know, you're not going to be successful. So you need to understand what's motivating that person. Are they trying to like make their job more efficient and automated? Are they, you know, are they the CFO who's trying to make sure that there's good ROI for them and for their company as a whole? Are you the person, again, who's going to have to implement it? Like, who are these people that you're dealing with, and what is it that they need from you to make them think that this is the best choice for them, to give them, to kind of relax some of their fears and objections. In some cases, if you're the champion, you're like, I know we need this. This is amazing. But then you're putting your neck out on the line, right? You're the one who has, you know, said A, we need this, and B, this is the right solution that we need. So how can you help alleviate some of the fears? How can you help them internally in their own company understand like why this is important, so that they don't have this fear of losing their job literally for buying a $50 million solution. So you kind of need to think about what's going on in their mind and help them along. There's friction everywhere. And if you can identify what that friction is, then you can alleviate it. If you're thinking about, this happens a lot with trials, people are like, oh, we have a 14, 30 day trial, and they just put them into it. But even then, they're not thinking about that friction point, right? So, you know, if you want them to have a successful trial experience, do they then need to have other people involved in that? And how do you help that person who's doing the trial get those other people involved and input? So understanding where those friction points are and just getting rid of them as much as you can will help with that journey, and actually shrink your sales cycle as well.
Well, and you know, as you were talking, I started thinking about all of those different constituents that are part of the buyer side. Is that they all have different jobs to be done,
right?
And, you know, their careers depend upon it. And you're not addressing, you know, those needs, you're in trouble. And so then that starts leading me to one of the things that you actually pointed out is, you know, the different parts of the buy versus the different parts of, you know, just the overall customer journey. So what is the difference between the customer journey and the buyer's journey?
Yeah, so I like to differentiate those. To me, the customer journey is that, you know, the customer lifetime, right? Like they are from the time that they, you know, understand what it is that you do. And they're like, oh, you know, maybe we need this product, all the way through to, I don't know, you've probably left the company by the time that customer's still in their customer journey, especially if you're a CMO. But so they're the people who are the end users who are going to be in that journey for a really, really, really long time. I mean, again, I do B2B. It's usually at least a 3-year, you know, a contract or an annual one, but oftentimes it's, you know, 10 years where, you know, like Salesforce, you're going to be with them pretty much for life. And so that's that customer journey, right? And it's interesting because the longer that solution lives in that company, right? Like again, Salesforce is a good, or Salesforce, Oracle, they're really good. They're, you know, at least 10 years, right? So that's a long journey. But honestly, you know, it's like, what do they say? Like, you know, if you think about this timeline of how long humans have been on the planet, like we've just been this much in the universe, that buyer's journey is only like the first 10% of that customer journey. 90% is them as customers. And how are you going to keep them, maintain them, you know, increase the value of your product and solution with features and functionalities and other benefits. So so that customer journey is really long. That buyer's journey is really that piece where they are looking at and evaluating and buying your product. So it's a much shorter piece of that customer journey.
Well, and you say that there's an important component called the map of influence people need to have. So what is a map of influence?
So a map of influence, I mean, it can, you know, this is my definition of a map of influence. It's something that I like to build. I like my teams to build, and I like sort of to expand on that as you're in an organization and trying to work and align. But basically what it is it's a document that helps you internally build that influence and trust so that you can actually do your job. You know, when it comes to, again, understanding what product is doing, what sales is doing, what customer success is doing for if you're a marketer, like what is it, how are you helping them? You're already helping them, but how are you helping them? And is it in a way that is strategic and in alignment with what the rest of the company needs to do? So really identifying, again, all of those areas where you can have influence, you either already have influence, you're already helping them, or you need to build influence. So I call it the map of influence. Mine's a spreadsheet. I usually stick it on a wall and it's like, you know, oh, hey, how can I help Bob in sales today? Or, you know, what does engineering need from marketing to, you know, make them feel like they're an essential core piece of what it is that you're working on, if you're working on a new feature, for example. And so really, it just lays out all of the different touch points that you have as a marketer. And these are all the areas that you can influence. These are areas that you should hopefully be able to show impact and results and value on. And again, it should all roll up to what that go-to-market strategy is.
Definitely stay in contact, build relationships, even for however their short tenure may be.
Right. I mean, maybe that's what, I don't know. It's crazy.
Okay. So you even mentioned this in the book, and a lot of times I like to ask this question. Yeah. If you had $1 million as a marketer, what would you do with it?
I do ask that in the book. Actually, I have a bunch of scenarios too. If I had $1 million, you know, it's... I think that there's always going to be areas where there's the areas that you divest in, which we talked about. They're non-strategic. They don't make sense. You shouldn't spend time or money or resources on them. But there's always times where you wish you had just a little bit more because you could do a little bit more, right? And again, it depends on your organization, your structure, you know, areas that you need to focus on. Usually what I call like the levers that we have in marketing. So like if we're going to potentially miss our revenue, or, you know, we're concerned concerned about something in particular. So I would always use those extra funds to pull or push levers, as I like to call it. Just kind of that extra over the top, a little bit of lift, those types of things is where I would spend my million. Honestly, it's so bad. Like $1 million really isn't that much anymore. It's like, if I had a dollar, what would I do with it? But I would definitely use it to either enhance or sort of, again, pull and push some of those levers that's going to help us just be a little bit more effective.
Okay. So then part of that, and I think people oftentimes gravitate to that because we unfortunately may think of it as, hey, this will fix my problem, is you know, marketing technology. So what kind of marketing technology does a company need?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you have your entire tech stack and it's going to be different for every company. And I think, unfortunately for marketers and that poor CMO, that revolving CMO, they're going to come in and that technology is already going to exist for the most part. That tech stack is already going to exist. So if you have, if you are at a startup and you have the option and potential of building out that tech stack, then that's great. And so the things you need to think about are what is going to help you basically capture and sort of look at over time those leads. So some sort of, you know, customer relationship management, CRM type product. And it could be, you know, it could be part of another, like HubSpot has multiple things now. Salesforce has multiple things. It's not just a CRM. So you need that way to capture and sort of cultivate and nurture those leads. And then you also need some sort of marketing automation system. And because again, the more you can automate, the better it will be. But I think even more to the tech stack that you have and the different things that you need in there is how it's set up. So even if your tech stack already exists, you really need to understand, again, those workflows, what is being captured, how it's flowing through, because you really have all the data you need between your CRM, your marketing automation tool, and your financial system, honestly, because that's where you're looking at, the sales that have happened, the sales cycle, the amounts increases, discounts, all of that stuff is captured in that financial system. And so if you have those and you can really understand the data that's going in and the data that you're looking for, not the data that's coming out, the data that you want to come out, then you can focus on that and make sure that they're being set up and run properly.
And also understanding that you have a swirly, twirly, hot mess that you need to.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's interesting. I also feel, and we've talked a little bit about this with the customer success and customer marketing, you need to think about it for the long term. Like, one of the things some companies look at and measure is, monthly average use. Like, are they going into your system every day, which is what you want a lot of your customers to do? Are they using it to its fullest extent? I was at a company one time and it was the things that the customers were asking for, we actually already had in the system. We just did a bad job of helping them understand that it exists and how to use it. So in some cases, they're not using it because you don't have a feature. Some cases, they're not using it because they think you don't have a feature. And so you need to really understand and dig deep into that. And that goes back to that whole customer and understanding how they're using it and what they need.
Well, and for me, when I started looking at, from an ecosystem as well as a maturation process, and I look at, B2B marketing, again, let me just say marketing, but anyway, we look at B2B marketing. I think we kind of have to look at the world as far as pre-COVID and post-COVID. And
yeah.
It gets me to thinking to ask you the question is, what does the future of marketing look like?
The future of marketing, that's up to us. Right. I mean, I've just given you some tools. We've had conversations about, what it means to sort of start owning marketing a little bit better and differently. And so I think that there's a lot of things that we can do. I do think, again, going back to that, marketing is not essential. Oftentimes, like with COVID or when we're heading into a downturn or even if there's just some uncertainty, the first thing to usually go is the marketing budget and then the marketers. And I think it's a huge mistake for companies to do that, because then you lose momentum. And in order to get that momentum back. You kind of have to start, you know, you were here and then you're here and then you're here and now you're back here and you've got to roll it back up. And so I think it's a big mistake for companies to lose momentum that way. But again, that goes back to marketers really helping people understand the value and impact they're bringing. Because I honestly, like if you have to make some dramatic changes, your product already exists. So you have customers and it's working for your customers now. If you have to make a choice, probably shouldn't say this out loud. I would focus on, you know, reducing my product budget before I would reduce my marketing and sales budget, right? Because and I would focus on customer marketing. If you're in a situation where you have to reduce your budget, I would definitely focus on customers. You've already acquired them. You know what they do. You know what they need, and it's easier to try to reduce churn and enhance and increase those accounts that you already have versus trying to get net new customers. It takes longer, and it's more expensive. And so there are things that you can do, even if you are in a situation where, for whatever reason, your budget's been decreased. But I do think that, you know, again, as marketers, we just need to really help people understand that value and the impact that we are bringing. And that will help us pretty much in any of these situations.
Well, and I mean, the data exists from a case study perspective. And there's the organizations who take the right approach. If you right. do go into a recession, when you come out, you bust out the fastest.
Right. Right. Because you haven't lost as much momentum. So, yeah.
Wealth of information. I can tell you, Christine Delviar, how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
Oh, yeah. So you can reach me on LinkedIn. And my website is ChristinaDelviar.com. Super easy to find that. Maybe not easy to spell. But you can find me there and happy to talk. I love having these conversations. I love hopefully helping people become better marketing professionals and enjoy their jobs a lot better. But overall, I mean, I think that marketers can really help their companies grow in revenue by thinking about these things that we talked about today.
Christina, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.